Welcome to Deep Roots Island Waves, stories about life's lessons from Indigenous voices, a collaboration between Clahoose First Nation and Cortez Community Radio. The 100-mile diet, the paleo diet, local, seasonal food, all inform current trends in nutrition and health. In this Deep Roots Island Waves edition, producer Manda O'Fox Gillespie explores foundational elements in varying traditional diets and their health implications.
Salmon Boy, a legend of the Seashell people, as retold by Donna Jo. Long, long ago, a boy lived in a village called Kalpilin, the winter home of the Seashell Nation. The boy's people lived in great longhouses along the seashore. It was a good place to live, but the people often went hungry during the long winter months. In those days, so long ago, the salmon did not fill the creeks and rivers of Seashell.
This story of Salmon Boy is a fantastical creation myth, and it's a story about how essential the life of animals were to one Indigenous community, or how the health of a people is intricately connected to the health of their food source. This connection is behind one of today's newest science buzzwords, epigenetics. Epigenetics is the study of how the expression of our genes can be turned up or down by environmental factors. We're learning that things we once considered hardwired, such as our tendency towards obesity and heart disease or even schizophrenia, could be influenced by our grandparents' diets, or something like our great-grandparents' exposure to certain chemicals, or even experiences, such as something that may have happened to our ancestors, like one winter spent very hungry or extremely stressed during periods of their childhood. Kusin is from the Sliaman Nation, otherwise known as the Herring People. She is part of a project to preserve the Sliaman traditional language and facilitates a cross-cultural program called the Blanket Exercise. Kusin, what is food to your people?
I find in like Western society, you know, we measure our richness in like education or money, but like for Indigenous people, we measure our richness in the traditional food that you have in your freezer. So I come from a very rich family with traditional foods.
I know you credit your grandfather for the wealth of traditional food wisdom in your family, and that he credits his learning to the grandmother who raised him. When your great-grandmother sat down for a typical dinner, what do you think she ate, and how does that differ from what you might eat for dinner?
Traditional meats, right? Like the deer. If you can get a deer, then you're good for several months. And that's the most valuable protein you can have, and it's so lean. And versus me buying a chicken at the store now, where it's just pumped full of chemicals, and it's definitely changed. My grandmother or my great grandmother would have definitely been like all seafood, like oysters. My dad has this huge photo of her. I'm not sure which shellfish she's preparing, but she's braiding it onto two sticks, and I think that was for toasting by the fire. But just the skill to be able to braid friggin' clams on a stick is like so outside of my realm. It's just healthier compared to now. Like if I'm tired, then I just go through the drive-thru, or like I don't have the time because I am in Western society to go out hunting or fishing for a day and then pay my rent as well, right? We're kind of like forced to be in this Western society. So it's like trying to figure out how to walk in between two worlds. Like, how do I honor my ancestors every day and be connected to them as possible, but also be successful in this new world that we're forced to live in? And with, like, food would probably be the biggest gap. One of the biggest gaps between us and our ancestors, just because everything's been so diminished. And it's just lack of resources.
When Western diet replaces a traditional diet, what are the obvious and less obvious things that are lost?
Herring. Like, we were a herring people. And then when the settlers came here, they totally wiped out the herring around here. Like, there's a lot of old photos of just how many fishing vessels were just out right in front of our beach here. So when things like that are removed from our culture, then you lose the language, like I was talking about, around herring. Herring is number one. The second one would just be the lack of resources that are now available because of logging or because of the mill here that's just polluted our waters. Like, for example, fishing is a lot more limited now. Even where you can dig for clams is a lot more limited now. And not just from the resources being destroyed, but also from the land being bought and sold, and we're not allowed to go there anymore, right?
Kusin says ultimately there is much more at stake.
The right to nourish your body the way you feel is important.
You're listening to Deep Roots Island Waves, stories about life's lessons from Indigenous voices. This episode brought to you in part by Literacy Now, Cortez Community Forest Co-op, Study Build, and private donors.
It's not a new idea that what we eat can influence our health and the health of our offspring. Perhaps this was best popularized by Dr. Weston A. Price, who worked as a dentist in Ohio more than 80 years ago. He looked around at his practice at the time and saw degenerative health issues from cavities and facial deformities to heart disease and diabetes, and wondered how it was that relatively affluent people in a relatively affluent country could be suffering from so many signs of ill health. So Dr. Price set off around the world to find and study as many Indigenous cultures and their diets as he could. Among others, he visited remote Swiss villages, Scottish Islanders, traditional Inuit, and the remotest tribal communities in Africa. And he found, as one would expect, that their diets were very different from each other, yet they were almost always high in animal fats and fat-soluble minerals. As long as the groups ate their traditional foods, they had splendid physical development, and their children had beautiful, uncrowded teeth with few cavities, despite often having poor dental hygiene and living in harsh conditions. Today, there is a charity based on the work of Weston A. Price. Sally Fallon Morell is the founder and president of that foundation, and she's famous in her own right as a champion of nourishing diets. She's also a farmer and the author of numerous books under the Nourishing Tradition titles. How do traditional diets differ from what we are being told to eat today?
What we are being told to eat is what I call a puritanical diet. It's low fat, low or no salt, high fiber, plant-based usually, and that's the diet that's approved by dietitians and that our government is telling us that we should eat. And it is such a deficient diet and also such an unpleasant diet. I mean, your food is just dry and no salt, and you cannot eat this way. And people think this is how they should eat, and they try it, and they, you know, stick to it for a while. But eventually, the body just revolts, and you end up eating the what I call the pornographic food, the junk food.
I noticed that when speaking with Indigenous people from the Pacific Northwest, that their traditional diets are heavy in animal fats. What's the significance of animal fats, and do some communities of people simply need more?
I do think that there's a type of genetic selection that occurs. I would certainly say that the people in the north here need more fat. Their traditional diet is 80% fat. Mm. And I doubt that any of them could convert carotenes into vitamin A very well.
Most people are afraid of fats. Why are they actually important?
One of the things you have in animal fats is something called arachidonic acid. It's an omega-6 fatty acid. One of these nutrients that's been demonized. They say that it causes inflammation. This is just not true. I mean, yes, if you need to have inflammation, it will help you have inflammation. And believe me, you'd be a basket case if you couldn't have inflammation when you'd injured yourself. I mean, it's very important. But arachidonic acid plays many roles in the body. It helps you have tight cell-to-cell junctions, so you have good digestion, healthy skin. But arachidonic acid is also what the body uses to make cannabinoids. And this is something most people don't realize. Our bodies make exactly the same substance that's in marijuana. They make our bodies make natural opioids, the same thing that's in opium, and we even make natural cocaine. And we have receptors for these substances. And the substances, the foods that we need to make these are first and foremost animal fats. And if we are getting plenty of animal fats, we have plenty of arachidonic acid along with vitamins A and D and cholesterol and the other things we need to make these feel-good chemicals, we will feel good all the time.
In Dr. Price's research, he notes that the indigenous communities he studied weren't free of degenerative disease simply because they were somehow genetically healthier. Those individuals or communities that he found that had adopted Western diets and the sugar, refined grains, and processed fats typical of the diets at the time suffered similar rates of tooth decay, infectious disease, and children born with poor immunity as the people he saw in his Cleveland practice.
In the north here, they have a better chance of reaccessing their traditional diet. I know that the Inuit and the Eskimos, many of them still do hunt and still do eat, you know, all the organs and the blood of the animals. So, and they fish and ferment the fish and everything. So there still are some people doing this, and I would just say to people, you need to seek these people out and eat their way and learn their way. Unfortunately, the very worst of the junk food is what reaches these traditional cultures.
Improving things often involves having access to the resources, such as the traditional foods, needed for ultimate health. Kusin told me that in her community, a shot of Uligan oil, they call it Kleena, a day, was known to be so valuable to health that it was considered a medicine that would give a person high immunity. Unfortunately, now it's become hard to come by and very, very expensive. Yet it echoes something that Sally Fallon Morrell regularly reiterates, and that is the importance of fat. What does eating enough fat actually look like in a person's diet?
Well, I think about 50% of your calories should be fat. More if you suffer from hypoglycemia, less if you have trouble digesting fats, which some people do, in which case you take that wonderful anthroposophical potion called Swedish bitters. But let's say 50%. I think that's a good number. And if you're eating a 2,400-calorie diet, that's 12 tablespoons of fat a day. 12 tablespoons a day. So that's a quarter of a cup at each of your three meals. Okay? That's 4 tablespoons of fat at each meal, and that includes the fat in your egg yolks, in your whole milk, in your cheese. If you don't have a lot of attached fats in your meal, then you put butter on everything.
There's something hopeful about the work of Dr. Price and the science behind epigenetics, that we can make better choices now that'll help create healthier futures for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
It takes several generations to have this physical decline, and it takes several generations to get back. And if you want to quote the Bible, you can say the sins of the parents. I like to say the mistakes of the parents are visited on the children 3 or 4 generations. Mm. And that's exactly what Price found.
Kusin, you've talked about all that has been lost to the Herring people and how you consider yourself responsible for rebuilding the foundation so that your daughter and her children can build upon it. You seem to find hope in this long view. What else do you hope for your daughter, particularly in terms of food?
I want her to be able to experience all of the traditional food that I have, like berries in the summer. And not just picking berries, but having a basket that she wrote to put her berries in. Or being able to just go fish off of Harwood and in Sarah Point and all of these places that, you know, our people still have names for. I just hope that our way of life will be not just secure, but thriving in the next couple of generations. Like, we're not there yet, but we're working on it.
When the salmon went upstream into shallow water, the little boy jumped out, went home to Kalpilin, and told the seashell people about the many wonderful things he had seen in the land of the salmon people.
At the end of the salmon boy story, the boy goes back to his starving people and tells them all he learned from the salmon. He tells his people that the salmon are a proud race of their own. The salmon creeks and rivers must always be kept clean and healthy. And each family must take only as many fish as it needed never wasting any. And in this way, the two communities came to know that their lives are interwoven.
Thanks to producer Manda O'Fox-Gillespie for this edition of Deep Roots Island Waves. Voice acting by David Russo. Senior producers are Morgan Tams and Greg Osoba. Series coordinator is Odette Auger, and Clahoose coordinator is Jacqueline Mathieu. Editor is Sean Cowell. Cortez Community Radio is grateful to the Community Radio Fund of Canada, Cortez Island Museum and Archive Society, Canada 150, and the Clahoose First Nation for their support. Find more at cortezradio.ca.